that on a Monday. You need that on a Tuesday.
Ah, come on.
You need that kind of every day. I'm not gonna talk too much on this episode because I got so much music that I wanna play, so...
Mein Haus ist dein Haus.
Thank you.
house in your house.
Track called Jazz Mojo by Martin Nowakowski. Then we had Virgo 4 with a track called Boing.
Boing, boing, boing.
Actually, I just want to say congratulations to Brazil for having elected a new president. This can only be, you know, such a great thing for Brazil from now on. I mean, so much hope. So I want to congratulate all my Brazilian friends and everyone living in Brazil. And yeah, I hope that Denmark is as lucky as Brazil tomorrow. Crossing fingers. All right. Check out this 808 cowbell. Ooh, with a lot of reverb. Here's Battle for Middle U by Julio Bashmore. Take it away.
Lay down, 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 l house, in your house.
Thank you.
yes, yes. The 808, I think perhaps that's my favorite drum machine of all the old school ones. I mean, the 909, that's pure techno insanity, or at sometimes 80s pop music. But, you know, the 808 is ding, ding, I don't know. It's a softer and it has a lot of depth. I mean, not dead, but, you know, deep. It's deep. That's what I want to say. Some melodic stuff from Oxia. The track was called 24 Hours. And I think in 24 hours, my new majestic computer will be up and running and ready. I don't know. I've been making new music and I'm excited to share it. But yeah, it's probably going to take a little while before the whole album is together and ready to come out. If you have any label suggestions that I should check out, please DM me on Instagram and let me know. Anyway, I want to play now a track that is perhaps not so housey, but still could be in that genre. It's a track by Daphne called Jiao. You know what's funny? I tried to Google his other artist name, but since I Googled Daphne, the Google wouldn't show me any other thing but Daphne Oram, which is kind of great. Can't really complain about that. You know, she was really a pioneer, one of the first to work with electronic music like tape machines at the BBC in England, alongside Delia Derbyshire,
who made the title track for Doctor Who.
So yeah, maybe afterwards go check out Daphne Oram. Shing. Shing. And now, I should say au revoir, hasta luego, see you soon in around a month or so. Until then, take care, and yeah, I want to talk more music next time. Less politics, more music. Let's have that as a promise! Okay, guess what? I'm actually on my new majestic computer right now. It's totally silent. I love it. I just wanted to give you a quick update from yesterday about the election. We fucking won. I'm so happy and relieved and everything that makes the heart light and feel good. My friend and I were like jumping in the air and
celebrating.
Yes! Yeah! Thank you for that. The universe has spoken.
And also, suck it, patriarchy.
Thank you.
house.
House. will je nooit meer zien. Want jij hebt me altijd bedrogen. Daarom,
daarom
vraag ik aan jou. Verdwijn vergoed uit mijn ogen. Ik haat die ene donkere nacht die jou bij mij heeft samengebracht. Ja, heeft samengebracht. Jij bent voorgoed uit mijn hart en vergeet nu al mijn smart. Ja, al mijn smart.
Toen je zei, ik hou alleen van jou, ging de hemel voor mij open. Maar nu is alles weer voorbij. Dus neem maar een ander voor mij.
Samengebracht, ja, heeft samengebracht. Jij bent voorgoed uit mijn hart en vergeet nu al mijn smart. Ja, al mijn smart. Vaarwel. Wil je nooit meer zien, want jij hebt me altijd bedrogen. Daarom,
daarom
vraag ik aan jou. Verdwijn voorgoed.
This is the story of the rise of an idea that has come to dominate our society. It is the belief that the satisfaction of individual feelings and desires is our highest priority.
Today we're going to tell you how to get whatever you want.
I wanted to live a different life that wasn't available to me in the image I was born.
I am here, look at me, notice me.
Previous episodes have shown how this rise of the self was fostered and promoted by business. They had used the ideas of Sigmund Freud to develop techniques to read the inner desires of individuals and then fulfill them with products. This final episode is about how that idea took over politics. It tells the story of how politicians on the left in both America and Britain turned to these techniques to regain power. They believed that they were creating a new and better form of democracy, one that truly responded to the inner feelings of individuals. But what the politicians didn't realize was that the aim of those who had originally created these techniques had not been to liberate the people, but to develop a new way of controlling them in an age of mass democracy. The roots of the story lie way back in the America of the 1920s with one man. He was called Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud. Bernays had been one of the inventors of the profession of public relations, and he was fascinated by his uncle's theory that human behavior was driven by unconscious sexual and aggressive drives. Many of Bernays's clients were large American corporations, and he was the first person to show them how they could sell many more products if they linked them through images and symbols to those unconscious desires that Freud had identified.
The strategy he offered them was that people could now look at the goods that were emerging within the society and not merely view those goods as things that they needed in order to deal with some specific material want, but also as goods which would stroke and respond to deep emotional yearnings. You know, how this bar of soap or this bag of flour will make you a happier, more successful, more sexually appealing, less fearful person, somebody to be admired rather than reviled. The powerful people in that world are those people who are capable of reading the public mind and giving the public what it wants in those terms.
And Bernays was at the heart of it.
Bernays was the guy who was the foremost articulator of the theories which were driving this new system.
By the 1980s, Bernays's ideas had come of age. A vast industry had grown up in America devoted to reading the inner desires of consumers. At its heart was the technique of the focus group. Previous episodes have shown how the focus group was invented by psychoanalysts employed by US corporations. The aim was to allow consumers to express their inner feelings and needs, just as patients did in psychoanalysis. The information was then used to promote and design new products that would fulfill those desires. And Edward Bernays, who was now nearly 100 years old, was celebrated as the founding father of this marketing world.
Hi, doctor. Good to see you. Come on up over here. There you go. Doctor, tell me again what the doctor is. What are we dealing with?
Well,
you're the father of public relations.
What we're dealing with really is the concept that people will believe me more if you call me doctor.
Oh, I see. It's a good idea.
And Bernays's ideas and techniques were also about to conquer Britain in the 1980s. Unlike America, the ruling elites in Britain had always distrusted the idea of pandering to the masses. It was epitomised by the patrician elite who ran the BBC. Even as late as the 60s, popular programmes were referred to as ground bait. Their real job was to lure the viewers into watching the more serious programmes the elite knew was good for them. And market research reflected this attitude. Individuals were observed and classified by market researchers according to their social class, from A through C2, D and E.
Probably they might be C2.
Yes, I think by the way they're carrying their luggage.
No taxi,
and all stuffed in the bags like that.
I think the lady possibly sets her own hair, which is always an indication.
The children are nicely dressed.
Yes, they are.
Probably a skilled worker.
A skilled worker, I would say so.
Yes,
I would say so.
Certain apprenticeship or done some qualifying.
Yes.
We agree then.
Yes, we think so,
yes.
When people were asked their opinion about both products and politics, they were selected by social class and asked only strictly factual questions about what they thought.
Well, leaving your own party sympathies on one side, who do you think will win this forthcoming
Labour.
Labour?
And tell me which you prefer.
Which party do you think you'll be voting for?
This time. Liberals.
You'll be voting for the Liberals.
And who do you think will be second?
Conservative.
This one.
Okay.
The idea that one might ask people what they themselves felt and desired and then give it to them was seen as alien to the ruling elites, which would challenge their belief that they knew what was best for the public.
There's evidence in other countries, in the United States for example, where pollsters have been used before elections to interpret the mood of the public, and then you give people more what they want to have and less what they ought to have. But again, this could be an edge to be more democratic, I don't know. It's very dangerous ground, I think, though, when polls are used in that way.
But then, in the economic crisis of the mid-70s, British industry was forced to begin to pay attention to the inner feelings of consumers. As the recession deepened, consumer spending fell dramatically. And the advertisers insisted that the only way for companies to survive was to make their advertising more effective. And to do this, they would have to delve into people's underlying psychological motives for purchasing. The advertising industry started to bring in Americans to run focus groups with British housewives.
Everyone is a unique person, and even though you're a group of 10 today, we don't want a group opinion. And we want to know your ideas and your thoughts, no matter how crazy it might be. Please let your imagination run wild, because that's how very crazy things like instant coffee got born. Now, can we get somebody, this lady, to be a kitchen sink? And kitchen sink, how do you feel with these things that are being used to clean you up?
Well, I've got to feel clean. I've got to be kept clean.
So
I feel that. I should hate it if I was all greasy, so I've got to be easy to clean.
Okay, now the housewife, this lady, what would you use to clean your kitchen sink?
A scouring powder. Of course, a cloth to apply the things on, and plenty of water.
Now, how do you feel as you're doing this chore?
Satisfied. Well satisfied when I have done it, yes. I'm doing my duty. I feel it's a job well done.
The consumers were encouraged to play at being products, from household cleaners to car seat belts. The aim was not to talk rationally, but to act out and reveal their inner emotional relationship to products.
Which firmly and unmistakably underlines...
And then a politician emerged who also believed that people should be allowed to express themselves. Instead of being controlled by the state, the individual should become the central focus of society.
Some socialists seem to believe that people should be numbers in a state computer. We believe they should be individuals. We're all unequal. No one, thank heavens, is quite like anyone else, however much the socialists may pretend otherwise. And we believe that everyone has the right to be unequal. But to us, every human being is equally important. A man's right to work as he will, to spend what he earns, to own property, to have the state as servant and not as master, they are the essence of a free economy. And on that freedom, all our other freedoms depend.
Mrs. Thatcher's vision was of a society in which the wants and desires of millions of individuals would be satisfied through the free market. This, she believed, would be the engine to regenerate Britain. And with her ascent to power, the advertising and marketing industries flourished. Their task was to find out what the British people really wanted and then sell it to them. In this new climate, the focus group flourished. And those who ran them borrowed from the techniques of psychotherapy to delve ever deeper into people's feelings about products.
We're trying to understand how people feel about brands, how they relate to brands, that is to say, what the brand's personality is as far as consumers are concerned. And there are a number of techniques which are very, very helpful for getting to that understanding. The consumer is given crayons to doodle, to express their feelings, to go inside their own head, pull out their feelings and somehow get them onto paper. And these are ordinary drinkers expressing their feelings about drinking Guinness. Here you see a rich, very female aspect of Guinness. So if you were describing a woman who somehow to you had that character, what sort of person is it?
Paula Yates used to lay in bed, surrounded with magazines, and chocolates like a 50s starlet.
Out of this research, the marketeers began to detect a new individualism. In particular, among those who had voted Conservative for the first time in 1979. They no longer wanted to be seen as part of social classes, but to express themselves. And crucial to this were the products they chose to buy.
We identified that there was this trend towards what might be called individualism, where people wanted to still be part of a crowd, but to express themselves as individuals within it, to have their own personalities, to be, I suppose, their own men.
I didn't want to be the same as everybody else. I wanted it to be
little bit different, a little bit individual.
It's quite individual upstairs. It's not remarkable, but I think it's quite individual.
It is expensive.
It's Italian.
It's Italian. It's expensive and it's good quality.
A little bit different.
Yeah, we want to set our own standards so nobody else has got what we've got.
We just didn't want it...
Be the same as everybody else.
We just want to be different.
Business responded eagerly to this new individualism, but it soon became one of the main forces driving the growing consumer boom in Britain. Using the data from the focus groups, manufacturers created new ranges of products that allowed people to express their individuality. Business also recategorized people. They were no longer divided by social class, but by their inner psychological needs.
If the primary need is security and belonging, we call the groups mainstreamers. If it's status and the esteem of others, then it's aspirers. If it's control, it's succeeders. And if it's self-esteem, it's reformers.
And this new marketing culture began to take over the institutions previously dominated by a patrician elite, in particular the world of journalism. The assault was led by the profession of public relations. In the past, PR had been seen as seedy and corrupt, but now it became a glamorous business, promoting products and celebrities. And one of the rising stars was another member of the Freud family, Matthew Freud, the son of the Liberal MP, Clement. What Freud and other PRs realised was that they could use their celebrities as levers to infiltrate advertising into the editorial content of newspapers. The newspapers were offered exclusive interviews with celebrities, but only if they also agreed to mention products made by Freud's corporate clients, in terms dictated by the company.
What happened with Freud's was that you effectively got some kind of product placement, or even product, the manufacturers of the product got some degree of control over how their products would appear in print. So if, for example, you did want to write about Caprice's passion for stuffed crust pizza, you would sign a contract which guaranteed that you would mention the firm Pizza Hut in at least twice in certain positions in the introductory paragraph of the article, that you would agree to run the Pizza Hut logo at such and such a size in such and such a place, and of course that you would agree to run the enclosed pictures of Caprice eating her stuffed crust pizza. There was no choice about how you would run this article in the press. You were effectively told how to run the article in the press.
By Freud's?
By Freud's. It's a rise of the corporate culture and the rise of business.
To traditional journalists, this infiltration of advertising into the editorial pages was a corruption of their profession. But to Mrs. Thatcher's allies, like Rupert Murdoch, who owned The Sun and The Times, it was part of a democratic revolution against an arrogant elite who had too long ignored the feelings of the masses.
They hate to see someone communicating with the masses. They feel that newspapers, the written word is not for the masses. That should be left to television, or perhaps to nobody. You're very proud of The Sun, and The Sun was not represented tonight in your film. You just took page 3, which everyone seems so fascinated with. About page 1, page 2, every other page of the paper. That was a typical piece of slanting and elitism by the BBC, who, after all, in order to get viewers for this programme, put on a very sexy episode of Star Trek, just which I was watching out in the room there.
Oh, I don't think they put it on to get us viewers. I think we just are lucky to follow.
They try to carry viewers into these show programmes.
You know
how it's done.
By the late 80s, Mrs. Thatcher and her allies in advertising and the media had brought the desires of the individual to the centre of society. As last week's episode showed, it was the same transformation that President Reagan had brought about in America. Both politicians had encouraged business to take over from government the role of fulfilling the needs of the people. In the process, consumers were encouraged to see the satisfaction of their desires as the overriding priority. To Thatcher and Reagan, this was a new and better form of democracy. But to their opponents in the parties of the left, they had summoned up the most selfish and greedy aspects of human nature.
Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher both embraced an economic philosophy that says the unit of judgment was not only the individual, but it was the individual's personal satisfaction, the individual's own unique happiness and well-being. It was, in a sense, the triumph of regarding individuals